Welcome back to
Talking
I know very well what you're talking about. You're talking
Jimmy Stewart.
I'm Tim Vanderberg, and my guest for this episode is film historian, author, and screenwriter Joseph McBride, who serves as professor in the cinema department at San Francisco State University. McBride is the author of Frank Capra, The Catastrophe of Success, Steven Spielberg, A Biography, and several other books, and has interviewed countless celebrities, including Jimmy Stewart, about his own career and on the subjects of Capra and John Ford. He has also written extensively on Orson Welles and was instrumental in getting the director's famously unfinished feature, The Other Side of the Wind, completed in 2018. We talked by phone recently about all of these things, and I hope you'll enjoy it. Well, where to start? Your career is, so notable. It's tough to even know where to begin. My first encounter with you would probably be with Rock and Roll High School.
Oh, yeah, great.
So I
saw that when it came out, probably?
I saw it, I believe it would have been HBO, and I actually caught it. We were at a friend's house. We were house-sitting for some family friends, and we watched it. My brother and I watched it, and I guess we immediately gravitated toward the Teenage Rebellion. So it was a fun one. Are you a Ramones fan?
Well, I've always been one since,
yeah.
I didn't know much about them until I saw the film, but they were a perfect choice for the film. I think they really make that film work, a lot of good things came together, but they're really crucial to the success of that film and why it endures, I think, they're so great. I was there for that, the big concert they have in the middle of the film. It's like 22 minutes long, and I spent hours and hours there. I think we shot for like 18 hours or something. It was a pretty wild experience. And I spent a little time with them, and they were very monosyllabic. They were strange guys, but I kind of liked that about them. They were weird, antisocial characters. And I think their songs are really sophisticated and terrific, and so I'm really glad they're in the film.
Yeah. It's a lot of fun. I'd seen that, and I saw E.T. probably in the theater that same week, probably within a couple of days of each other. So that's the time frame that when I saw the movie. And you've obviously interviewed and spent a lot of time researching Steven Spielberg. Is he one of your favorite directors and subjects?
Oh yeah, he's probably my favorite current director. My favorite modern director is Truffaut. But I've always liked Spielberg since way back when, and one reason I wrote the book was, I was, at the time, there had been no, there was a short biography of him that was pretty good in the 80s, but there hadn't been a good serious biography of him, and there even hadn't been a good critical study, and he was still being blasted by the critics, the reviewers. That improved after Schindler's List, but I've always thought he was a great director.
Do you have a favorite film?
Of
Spielberg's, yes.
Close Encounters and Schindler's List are both great. Schindler's List, I think other directors might have done, a great film of it. Maybe not as good as his, but Close Encounters, nobody else in the world could have done that film. It's very special and very personal, so that's one I value a lot. But there are quite a number of good ones. What about you?
For Spielberg, I do like both of those. I think I just have a personal leaning toward Raiders of the Lost Ark. And just the experience of that, I thought it was, it hit me at the right time. I was 11 years old, and seeing movies, that was about the time that I started seeing movies about every week. The theater I went to had two screens, and they would change out every Friday. The movies would change out, and so I went either once or twice a week for a good 9 or 10 year span. And that was right at the front of that, and so I mean, it's just a great movie, but it also just hit me at the right time too.
Well, I think we value the films that we liked when we were young, not only as adolescents, but maybe as people in their 20s, a lot of the
Yes.
Which is a big flop, but I, that was the first film I saw in a theater twice. I was 10 years old, and I liked it so much I went back to see it, and I kind of like that film. I think it's pretty good.
Oh, yeah.
Kind of too old for the part, but I, in a way I don't care because he fits the role so well in other ways, you know.
I agree. You forget about the age just minutes into it. You get right into
it. Yeah, he seems to have the spirit of Lindbergh and the ambiance, and I mean, you know, he's a great actor, and it's, I mean, part of the Lindbergh story was he was a young man, but Stewart sells it, you know.
I tend to like any Stewart film where he yells excitedly, you know, yay!
Yeah, right. Yeah, the scene where he sees land in Ireland is wonderful, isn't it?
Yes, yeah. We can start right there with Jimmy Stewart. You have had a number of encounters with him. I guess first you have a writing credit, writing his AFI Life Achievement Award, the special for the award. How did that come about?
Well, I was a screenwriter I started writing screenplays in the 60s. I moved to Hollywood in 73, and I was writing screenplays, and it took me a while to sell one, and then when I started selling them, I quit my job in Variety. I was a film critic and a reporter, and so for about 7 years, I was a full-time screenwriter, and in 1980, I got the job through my agent, proposed me for this job writing the AFI Awards, which was perfect for me because I'm a film scholar, and I like those shows because I thought of them as film criticism for the masses, or film history for the masses, you know, kind of a way to honor really great people and bring out their qualities in an entertaining way. We couldn't get too highbrow or theoretical or anything, but, you know, I tried to write the speeches in a way that would illuminate their bodies of work, and so it happened that the one they were honoring was Jimmy Stewart at the time, and he's always been one of my favorite actors, so I was thrilled to do that, and I had a great time. And then I went on to write the ones for Fred Astaire, Frank Capra, and John Huston and Lillian Kesh. So I did those for 5 years. Those were the best experiences I had as a screenwriter because I got, you know, they were exciting to work on, and I wrote them with the producer, George Stevens Jr., who did a good job producing, and he respected my work, and so it was the first time, really, that my writing had appeared on the screen unadulterated, and, you know, it was pretty much the way I wrote it. And I got to work with all the actors, and it was a thrill for a youngish screenwriter to work with all these legendary figures. It's very unusual, I think, to have a chance to do that. And so over the years, I worked with, David Niven and Claudia Colbert and the stars, you know, Gish and Houston and Capra, and Stewart hosted our Jimmy Stewart, our Frank Capra tribute, and so I worked with him closely on that. And over the years, I did other things with him. I wrote the ANTA Award for him, which is a theater group that honored him for his work in the theater, which you don't hear much about. So I wrote that show, which was a lot of fun, and we really did something very, very amusing. We had three groups of young actors spoofing Jimmy Stewart. We had three guys who were different kinds of actors, but they were all terrific spoofing him. And we did skits as if Jimmy Stewart starred in Streetcar Named Desire, Fiddler on the Roof, and, my gosh, what was the third one? But they're all really funny to see him doing those, and the actors did really well, and Harvey Limbeck directed those. He was a terrific actor on the Bilko show and in Billy Wilder's Dalek 17, etc., and he was right. Really the best director I've ever worked with, and that was a fun thing to do. And then I interviewed Stewart a few times, and I was on the set of The Shootist, which was John Wayne's last film, and Stewart plays his doctor, as you know. He gives him his diagnosis of cancer, and I was there for 2 days watching that scene being shot, which is really historic. And so I got to observe him at close range, and I'm probably forgetting a couple of other things I did talking about Jimmy Stewart on the day he died, which was a real honor, and got to express appreciation. In the course of that, I quoted Andrew Saris's line that Jimmy Stewart was the most complete actor personality in the American cinema, and I said that he was probably the best American film actor, and the host really seemed surprised, like they didn't quite realize how great he was, you know. So I was fortunate to know Stewart. He was an enigmatic man, very friendly, very willing to talk, but it was hard to coax certain things out of him. He wasn't the most articulate guy in the world, oddly enough, even though he went to Princeton. You know, he was very smart, but he was cryptic in expressing himself. For example, I tried to get comments from him on different directors, and he made some good comments. Like, I interviewed him for my John Ford and Frank Capra books, and he made some specific comments, but he tended to say the same thing about every director, that he liked the fact that they worked visually and they didn't have a lot of dialogue, which is actually not totally true. The Ford films, he has a lot of dialogue, and Lubitsch's Shop Around the Corner has a lot of dialogue, etc. Yet those directors, and Capra and other great directors he worked with, were very visual, and most of them come from silent films. But Hitchcock, Lubitsch, Wilder, Ford, you know, they're very different kinds of directors, but it was hard for him to differentiate what he did for them. And I couldn't get anything out of him about World War II, which was frustrating because, you know, it's a fascinating period in his life. And I would ask him about it, and, you know, I respect the fact that he didn't talk about it much. He was, you know, men who fought in the war, and my father was in the war, and I knew a lot of veterans. They didn't really talk about it much. That was kind of the thing at the time. Men didn't talk about those things. And, but, you know, real people who were in combat, I found, were not inclined to brag about their exploits. And it was traumatic for him as well, so I couldn't get him to, you know, I'd say, did it change you? Because most people think it changed him to some extent. And he would admit that it had, but he said, I can't explain how. So I guess, in a way, he didn't really know. But in a way, actors often are like that. They're more intuitive than conscious of what they're doing, and that may be necessary in certain actors to be as good as they are.
I know what you're talking about with some of the things he said about different directors, and I wonder if he just falls into default mode in interviews. I was actually going to ask you along those lines if he seemed spontaneous at all, or if he, again, just went back to tried and true statements that he had delivered.
Well, not as much as some people. I mean, there were a lot of people I interviewed who told the same stories over and over again. Stewart had a few favorite stories, like they all do, and I mean, I do that too, but he was pretty loose talking. You could bring up anything, and he, you know, some things he had more to say than on other subjects, but he was a great storyteller, among other things, as you know from watching him on, say, The Tonight Show. He used to be on The Tonight Show with Johnny Carson. He'd come out and tell funny stories, and he actually wrote poems, and he would read poems, and they were very funny and touching, and he sent me a copy of his book of poetry, which I thought was awfully nice of him. He loved to talk about his horse, Pie, for example, and I got a long story out of him about that. And so I think he enjoyed that more than anything else, you know, telling stories and making comments about people. And but he was a somewhat difficult guy to interview, not because he was, you know, uncooperative. It was just that it was hard for him to express himself verbally what he was trying to do. Mm.
Do you recall your first meeting with Mr. Stewart?
Boy, that's a tough one. I don't know. Maybe it was on the AFI show. I can't recall for sure. It just seemed like I'd known him for a long time. And one time I had lunch with him at the Beverly Wilshire Hotel, which he owned part of, actually. And I walked in. I didn't recognize him because he wasn't wearing his toupee. He had a toupee. And he looked a lot older and different, but he was the same guy when you sat and talked to him, you know. So I had a lot of encounters with him, and it was just, it's a real easygoing, friendly guy, as everybody kind of knows, that he was those roles, and then he, the Hitchcock films, starting with Rope, but later on as well, he's very neurotic and almost psychotic in certain films like Vertigo and Rear Window, terrific in those parts, and so he had an amazing range, and even in Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, Capra tapped into his anger and his toughness, that character is naive to an extent that's almost criminal, actually. One of my students pointed out that he's so innocent, he doesn't even know who's running the politics of his state, and he's the publisher of a statewide newspaper, and what's that about? And it sort of changed my view of that character. That's one of my favorite films. I think he gives an amazing performance, but the fact that he's so ignorant of politics it makes him kind of culpable in a sense when he gets to Washington, but then he wises up, of course, and gets very tough and combative, and Capra conveys that really well. So Capra was into that, and then Lubitsch in Shop Around the Corner, which I just showed to my class on Lubitsch, in the Shop Around the Corner, he plays a rather unpleasant character. He's very angry and quite hostile in many ways to Margaret Sullivan, who works under him, and he's kind of bullying and paternalistic in a bad way, and it makes the film interesting that the two of them don't like each other very much in real life, in the office, or I mean in the shop where they work, but they're writing these love letters, and so it's a good commentary on human psychology, the difference between our conscious and subconscious, and then it's reconciled at the end of the film, but that kind of astringency keeps the film from being too sentimental, and I think that's rather bracing. But Lubitsch, again, Lubitsch was a good student of human nature. He tapped into the angry, neurotic side of Stewart. He also plays a man who's very insecure in that film, and at one point she calls him an insignificant little clerk, and he's really devastated, partly because he knows that's what he is. He's frustrated with his job, and he has higher ambitions, but he doesn't know how to realize them, and there's a very similar scene in It's a Wonderful Life after the war when Lionel Barrymore says you're just a little clerk, and Stewart is so upset by that that he actually tries to kill himself. And so there's that dark side of Stewart that was always existing even before he went to war. He was a bomber pilot in World War II, and he led as many as 1,000 bombers into combat and bombing German cities. And it was a tough experience for him. And Capra told me the story. He added some details. People have heard the story, but not the whole story, that on It's a Wonderful Life, Stewart was very discouraged about coming back to acting. And he said, I don't think acting is a decent job for a man. And Capra asked Lionel Barrymore, who, of course, was a great veteran actor, to give him a pep talk about acting. And so he called him aside and talked to him. And he said, what's this I hear about you saying it's not decent to be an actor? And Stewart unloaded on him. And Lionel Barrymore said to him, well, I suppose you think it's more decent dropping bombs on people. Capra said, boy, that did it for Jimmy. After that point on, he said, I'm going to be the best damn actor in the world. And he stopped feeling bad about it. I think there was a tendency among male actors in that period to think there was something not totally masculine about being an actor. There was an old prejudice about that. But I think also being in the war, encountering the harshest kind of reality, really did have an impact on him. It deepened his roles, and that's one reason his post-war roles are so great.
Right. Along those lines, I think it really resonated with him to, embrace the idea of giving people pleasure. And if I recall, Lionel Barrymore talked to him about that, too. And
That's right. Yeah, he said, we give people a good time, and that's really important in this world. And Stewart really believed that, and he loved his public, and he was very very nice to his fans, and very grateful. I thought when he did his speech at our AFI Awards, he thanked the public, which I hadn't heard very many people do in those kind of speeches, and I thought that was very gracious. That speech, by the way, was written by Hal Cantor, who is a very good Hollywood comedy writer who worked with Stewart on his TV series, and Stewart very cleverly would hire Hal Cantor to write his public speeches. I wrote the ones that he did for the Capra tribute, but
Yeah, I think people would be surprised to think about how calculated his public persona was. And I see someone like Steve Martin, who seems very obvious that he does the same thing. He goes on talk shows for years, and everything was really planned out. And those are two actors that I've greatly admired over time, Steve Martin and Jimmy Stewart. And so I was actually watching the AFI tribute to Frank Capra that you wrote, and I noticed that Steve Martin was there.
Funny. He had one of the funniest lines that he ad-libbed, where he said, you know, I know Frank Capra very well. He and I have been friends for more than 80 years. Yeah. You know, he was spoofing those kind of shows.
Yes.
Actually, one reviewer was offended by that and said it was ages, but I just thought it was really funny.
Oh, yeah, no.
Capra got a big laugh out of that.
Was that something that Steve wrote, or did you write that?
No, he put that in there. Okay. You know, what I did on those shows was I tried to work with the actors as much as possible to make it sound like them, and sometimes, yeah, you know, people didn't realize it was written, because I think I did a pretty good job of knowing how to write for different kinds of people and making it sound like them. But part of the way I did that was to go and talk to them at length beforehand, and I would use some of their own words and then shape it into a speech. But sometimes they would ad-lib something. I mean, when I started those shows, I asked George, our producer, I said, now, do the actors come in with their own speeches, or do we write them? And he laughed, and he said, Joe, these are actors. They need lines.
Yeah.
And one time I was writing for Eva Marie Saint on the Gish program, and through a series of problems, you know, I wasn't able to write that show until the last 2 days. You know, George wasn't really focused on the show. He didn't particularly like doing a tribute to a silent movie actress, so he didn't really cast the show until the last minute, and then CBS got nervous, and so I had to write it real fast. But I got a phone call from a man who didn't identify himself, and he said, Eva Marie Saint is very nervous. She's got to give a speech in 2 days, and she doesn't have any lines. She needs to write away. Obviously, I realize this is her husband, Timothy Hayden, who is the director. And I said, I'll send it to her right away. So I dropped everything, and I wrote it in 30 minutes and sent it to her. And he called back and said, no, she loves it. She's great. And she was terrific. But, you know, that's an example of actors really needing help. But a few people would come in with speeches of their own, like Audrey Hepburn had a wonderful little speech she wrote about Fred Astaire, so that was great if they could do that. But quite often, you know, Betty Davis on our Capra show, the producer said, you know, is there anything special you want to say? And she said, no, I have nothing to say. She and Capra didn't get along, so I wrote her a speech about how Capra was a great director. I had her explain that. And she said, perfect. But then at the rehearsal, she said, would you mind if I change a few words here and there? And I said, geez, no, you're Betty Davis, my gosh. And if she had changed it in any way that I didn't like, I would have worked with her on it, as I did with people. And, but it came out great. But most of the time, they needed help, you know. But I think Stewart was super smart, as you say, to craft his image. Steve Martin is a writer, though. He's written screenplays, and Stewart was not.
Right.
Except for his poetry. He wrote funny poems, but the fact that he carefully crafted it, it doesn't mean that it was phony at all, because he was that kind of guy. I think he, you know, he kind of maybe exaggerated for comic effect sometimes, his stammering and hemming and hawing, but he doesn't overdo it in most of his films, but he was aware that that was funny, and you know, he was a smart man, and he knew his effects. I'm sure he did a lot of thinking, you know, preparation for roles, so that he was a conscious actor in the sense of how am I going to do the scene, how am I going to read the lines, but maybe not explaining it, but
you've touched on a lot of things here. I wanted to go back to It's a Wonderful Life for a minute. And you've interviewed Donna Reed, and yeah. I think people were surprised to learn that Jimmy actually didn't want to work with her again, just maybe partly because of the failure of It's a Wonderful Life, and he just didn't really leave anything to chance.
I didn't know that he didn't want to work with her again. That's interesting.
Well, there are some interviews with her daughter where she says that, and so she was a little bit bitter toward it, but I think it was just the fact that the film didn't do well, and he thought, well, that might have been, you know, maybe a chemistry thing was partially to blame, and so he just didn't take that risk.
So who was better, the daughter or Donna Reed?
Donna Reed.
Oh, that's actually interesting.
Yeah.
Well, she was a super nice lady, one of the nicest people I met in show business, a very sharp lady, too. Well, it's interesting. At one point, she proposed to me, she said, you know, why don't we do a sequel to It's a Wonderful Life? And she said, I'd love to be in it. And I went to Capra, and I had some ideas for it, but he didn't like the idea of a sequel to It's a Wonderful Life, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And he was probably right. It's kind of like Spielberg never wanted to do a sequel to E.T. But, so at least Donna Reed wanted to work with him. But I suppose it was very crushing that the film flopped. I mean, it was not a disaster. I mean, it grossed over $3 million, but it cost, like $3.5 million, I think. And so that's what sank Liberty Films, the company that Capra had created with Wyler and Sam Briskin and George Stevens. And Capra kind of panicked and sold the company. He pushed his partners into selling the company to Paramount Pictures, which they all regretted. Although Stevens made a couple of great films for Paramount, and Wyler made good ones, and Capra did not. But I think it must have been a terrible letdown. They did this wonderful film that, you know, that they both thought was their favorite. Although Capra privately told me he thought Mr. Smith Goes to Washington was his favorite film. He would tell people Wonderful Life was, but I said, why do you think Mr. Smith was your favorite? And he said, well, it's a bigger film. It's about our country. You know, it's about our ideas and behind our country. And the first actor that he was going to cast in that film was Gary Cooper, because he had done Mr. Deeds Goes to Town, and they actually announced the film as Mr. Deeds Goes to Washington. And then he gradually decided to cast Stewart. It was partly because Sam Goldwyn had Cooper under contract. It was hard to get him, but he told me, he said, I thought of Stewart because Jimmy could handle an idea. He said he had been to Princeton, and he said Gary Cooper wouldn't know an idea if it hit him over the head. So that comes across, his keen intelligence and sophistication, despite being so innocent at the beginning of the film. He gets things pretty fast when they're explained to him. But one thing that's great about that film is Jean Arthur's performance as his secretary, who really is the one who knows Washington, and she knows how laws are created, etc. And when you watch the film again, it's fascinating. The first third or half of the film, she does most of the talking, and he's more passive, and then he gets in control and gives a great filibuster. But I said to her, I got to know her pretty well, which was unusual. Very few people got into her world. I said, you were so great in that film. She said, well, they gave me a lot of great words and a lot of great speeches. So she was paying tribute to the writers. But she also said she preferred Cooper to Stewart. She said, with Gary Cooper, he's just there. He's very natural. And she said, with Jimmy Stewart, I get a little tired of his hemming and hawing, which I thought was kind of surprising because, I mean, they're both great in those films. But, you know, that was just her personal point of view.
Yeah, it makes me wonder if he rubbed her the wrong way at some point.
Yeah, you don't know with her. I mean, she was quirky and interesting character and very... She also kind of made fun of him a little. She said he knew it was the greatest role of his life, and so he would drive no more than 10 miles an hour to the studio, or he didn't want to have an accident, which was kind of making fun of him. But, I mean, maybe I would have, too, if I were doing that part.
Oh, yeah.
It was such a great part. You know, one thing in my book on Capra, I struggled for, I mean, I wrote that over 7.5 years. I had a lot of time to think about everything. But the carefully calculated, you know, his walk and his way of talking. He told me, he said the only trick he had was pausing in the middle of a sentence and not pausing at the end of the sentence. And he said he did that so they would keep looking at him while he was talking, and then they wouldn't look away when he stopped talking, which I thought was very clever. Oh. And that actually gives a certain vulnerability to his character in a way that makes him seem hesitant and somewhat insecure, which is interesting for such a strong man. But Wayne manages to do that too, and so people say, well, he's not acting, but to me that's the height of movie stardom, and that's what stars actually are all about, is you know, the role becomes them because they have a certain persona they've created that you like. That's why, you know, if you didn't like it, you wouldn't go back and keep seeing them. But stars are people, by definition, the public wants to keep seeing, but they can alter their persona within, from role to role, and Wayne did that in a number of ways, but Stewart did it more dramatically. I mean, he had a wider range, and yet he always seemed like Jimmy Stewart. And one mistake we made on the Stewart tribute, I wrote a line where he said he was always an American. And then I realized later, hey, that's not true. In The Mortal Storm, he plays a German, and in The Shop Around the Corner, he's a Hungarian. Mm-hmm. But he seems kind of like an American. Those were the days when Hollywood actors would play any nationality without an accent, and we would just suspend disbelief and go along with that. But he seems like an all-American figure, doesn't he? I mean, he's got all the qualities that we idealize. But he's Jimmy Stewart, whether he's in Hungary or Germany or Washington or wherever, the Wild West or whatever.
Or a Paris sewer worker in 7-10.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, that's right. That's yeah. Right, in 7-10.
Yeah.
Yeah, so there's three where he's not an American. But his range is extraordinary. I mean, the guy who plays in Vertigo is one of the most complex characters in film history. And Rear Window, he's quite disturbed. And Rope is kind of a stretch for him, playing a professor who's into Nietzschean philosophy. And some people think, gee, you know, could we believe that? But I believe that guy. I mean, he seems like an intellectual who's kind of cut off from questions of morality, and then he regrets it when his pupils go out and kill somebody.
Yeah.
And I find that a good performance.
I was wondering about Vertigo and how tied to that movie you are, being in San Francisco.
Yeah. I also wrote the documentary Obsessed with Vertigo, New Life for Hitchcock's Masterpiece, which is on the DVD and Blu-ray.
Oh, yes,
Vertigo. I've seen. So I got to, we didn't have, Jimmy Stewart had died before then, unfortunately, and I had kind of said, we should find some interviews with him and have his voice at least, but the director didn't do that for some reason. But we did a good job, I think, of showing how the film was made, and then it's also about the restoration of the film. But when you're in San Francisco, you think of Vertigo all the time, when you see the Coit Tower that you can see in the film and other locations. And there are Vertigo tours that people give. It's such a popular film. And our director, Harrison Engel, told me he thinks he did the first Vertigo tour when he was a kid. When the film came out in 1958, he said he liked it so much he went to San Francisco and looked up all the locations, which I was impressed with.
You've met a lot of people. Who stands out to you as someone that you would, you know, you'd say you really enjoyed spending time with?
Well, that's an interesting question. Yeah, Richard Lester was one, the director. I did a book called Two Cheers for Hollywood, which is my collection of interviews and articles. And I have an interview with Richard Lester, who directed Hard Day's Night, and he was just wonderful to talk to, and I really enjoyed that. Lillian Gish was a delight to talk to. I spent time with her over the years. Not an awful lot, but spent a lot of time with Howard Hawks, who was very congenial and very smart. He was a kind of guarded guy emotionally, too, so you didn't get close to him on a kind of friendly, hanging-out level. Orson Welles, I spent a lot of time, you know, over the last 15 years of his life. I'm in the film The Other Side of the Wind, which finally came
Yeah, I read that your first week in Hollywood, you met John Ford, Orson Welles.
Yeah, Jean Renoir, my three favorite directors.
That's incredible.
I also met Peter Bogdanovich, who was at the time a young filmmaker who had made Targets, which I really admired. And I was emulating him because he was interviewing these old directors, and so I wanted to look him up. So I went to the Larry Edmonds bookshop, and I talked to the nice guy who was the proprietor, and he gave me Peter's phone number. And I called him, and he said, "I'm on the other line with Orson. Could you hold on?" And I was stunned because I was writing a book on Welles, but I had no idea he was back in the United States. He was always kind of off in Europe, and you didn't know how to find him. And then he said, "Welles would like to talk to you." So I called him the next day, and he invited me to be on The Other Side of the Wind, which was a shock because I never acted. But he was looking for a young, sort of nerdy film buff, film historian character to run around and ask the old director played by John Huston sort of silly, pretentious questions. And I had met Peter in the interim, and he thought I was very funny and perfect for the part. And so they put me in that. So by the end of the week, I was in this Welles film, but I met Ford and Renoir and Welles. And I had called Hitchcock, too, and Hitchcock left a message at my hotel saying he'd be happy to see me, and the hotel didn't give me the message in time. So. But I thought every week in Hollywood would be like this. I didn't realize this was the pinnacle. This was the greatest week I would ever have.
That's pretty unbelievable. You did actually meet Hitchcock later on. You're on the set of Family Plot, correct?
Yeah, I was fortunate. Being on Variety was a terrific job for me because, I back in Wisconsin, I had sort of a dim idea of how films were actually made. And I interviewed a few filmmakers in the Midwest, but when I came to Hollywood, I got on the sets of films through Variety, and it's not the same way anymore. They're much more guarded about letting journalists on the sets and even talking to people. But I was able to go on the sets of just about any film I wanted and talk to anybody I wanted. I'd get them on the phone and then go over and see them, and it was just a dream come true. And so I spent 2 days watching Hitchcock shoot Family Plot, which is fascinating because it was a lot different from people thought. He, drew every shot ahead of time or had somebody draw them and was very rigid, but he wasn't at all. Turned out he did that for his action sequences and special effects sequences, but the dialogue sequences he would direct like any other director. He would kind of let the actors do the scene and watch them and film it, figure out how to film it. And so fascinating to watch him do that and then making up shots as he went along. And my friend Bill Crone did a whole book on, based on that called Hitchcock at Work. He was inspired by my experience there. And I saw, as I said, I was on the set of The Shooters for 2 days. That was one of my big thrills, with watching Don Siegel direct Wayne and Stewart and many other films. Some films not so great, but, it was really interesting just watching the whole process, and I've learned an awful lot from that.
Yeah, it's interesting you're on the last film that John Wayne made. What are your memories of that shoot?
Well, it was great watching the two guys together because they were so respectful and professional, of course. And, I kind of watched as they would sort of work out physical details. A lot of acting in films is just, how do you make this move? How do you pass? Like, Wayne had a pillow that he used because he had cancer in the film. And so they were kind of fiddling with that and trying to pass it back and forth, and then Stewart was fiddling with his medical equipment, and it was a very emotional scene. Obviously, that's the scene, where Wayne finds out he's dying, and he had had cancer before, as we know. And during the shooting, I went outside with him on a studio street, and he was being interviewed by a TV company about cancer, and he said he was in remission and feeling good, and it's ironic because then he came back, but Wayne was, it was very interesting to see the difference between them. Wayne was a very boisterous, convivial fellow who chatted with everybody, made jokes, and had fun with the crew, and was kind of trying to boss the director around. And Stewart, by contrast, sat in a chair very quietly, and I tried to talk to him then, and he wouldn't really communicate, and I thought, well, he's in his own world, he doesn't want to, talk while he's working, but
Right, I
found out a real difference, you know. And so I didn't get to interview him on that set. I interviewed Wayne, went into his trailer with him. It was a motorhome that he had parked outside the set, and then I interviewed crew members and Siegel. And Siegel was telling me how Wayne was trying to tell him how to direct the film, and he said he eats directors for breakfast, but when he tries to eat me, he'll get indigestion. I remember. But Stuart seemed very cooperative. You know, I mean, Wayne was cooperative, but he was more controlling. He kind of, you know, he wanted to be a director when he started, and I think he kind of almost directed his later films in some ways. But when he had Don Siegel, who was a tough guy, Siegel said, "I have tremendous respect for these two guys. You know," he said, "I've worked with all the great stars," because at Warner Brothers, he used to do the montages for films. So he said, "I worked with Cagney and Bogart and all these people, but it was the first time I felt in awe of my stars." And yet, you know, Wayne was a more controlling guy, and I don't think Stewart was like that at all. He was more willing to be molded by the directors. But, you know, since he was introverted and thoughtful, he would bring his own preparation to the characters as well. John Huston told me one of the ways he directed actors was to do as little as possible, to say as little as possible, because he said if you cast the right person, you don't need to talk to him very much. He said it's mostly casting, and when you have Jimmy Stewart in the film, you probably don't have to say much, just maybe a little more of this or a little less of that, and that's about it.
But that's pretty accurate. Back to Orson Welles. So this film, The Other Side of the Wind, just came out on Netflix within the past couple of weeks. What do you think of the results?
Well, I love the way they finished it. It was a terrific job they did. A very expert team. Frank Marshall and Philip Jan Rimsa were the producers, and Peter Bogdanovich was one of the executive producers. And Bob Murawski did an amazing job of editing the sound. Scott Millan, who's a four-time Oscar winner, did a fantastic job of the editing, and it was really a first-class operation all the way through, all the best people in the world you could get for that. And I was with the film for 48 years because I started shooting the first day in 1970 and continued until the last day in 76, and then over the years I tried to see if I could help raise funding to complete this film, because Welles ran into all kinds of financial and legal and political issues. And in the 90s, nothing was happening with it, so I called Gary Graver, the cameraman, and I said, let's really push this film and try to sell it. And Touch of Evil had come out again in a restored version, and I thought this is a good time to try again, because it did well at the box office, too, and so there was some interest, but we showed a rough assembly that Gary put together, and it wasn't very well put together, and it turned people off, unfortunately, because even people in the film business have trouble looking at rough cuts. This wasn't even a rough cut. Welles had cut 42 minutes of scenes, but then Gary threw in a lot of miscellaneous stuff. It had the mistaken look of a sort of complete film, but there was a lot missing, and it looked very rough, and the visual quality was rough because it was a dupe. And we just couldn't get anywhere. Everybody turned it down. It's also a very, you know, it's an experimental, offbeat film. Very unusual structure. It has two storylines going on at once. There's a film within the film, and very rapid cutting. And everybody turned it down. Spielberg, Lucas, Clint Eastwood, Oliver Stone, you name them, various companies. And Showtime was interested. They actually made us an offer in 1998 for $3 million to finish it. And I wanted Peter Bogdanovich to be the guy who did the technical work on finishing the film, and I was going to be a producer. And as soon as we made the deal, Peter and Oya Kodar, who was Welles' companion and collaborator on the film, she owned his share of the rights. They both fired me from the project. They felt they didn't need me, and then the project soon collapsed. And I don't know. I felt if I had been on it, it would have come out a long time ago. But I just decided, even though it was unjust, I decided to back away and not call they finished it, and they make the point in there that they might not have been able to finish this film with the technology that existed as little as, you know, 5 or 10 years back. So because of computers and digital editing and all kinds of things, they could do amazing feats of reconstruction that are very hard to, would have been hard to do in an analog world. I think we could have done it, but it would have taken longer. It would have been really hard in some ways. But so I'm just as happy that I was not involved directly. But then I was brought in as a consultant when they started. Philip and a producer named Jens Kostner Kahl, who's a German producer, were both trying to get the rights, and Jens gets a credit on the film too. They both came to me and wanted to know the history of the project, so I gave them a lot of advice. And then when the film was in production, they brought me on as a consultant with Jonathan Rosenbaum, another Wales scholar, and we both looked at the intermediate cut of the film in January, and I saw it 4 times, and I wrote a long memo with suggestions. I thought it was very good, but I had some suggestions to improve it, and they took some of those suggestions, and so we were consultants. And then since it's come out, I've been writing about it and doing interviews and going to screenings, helping to introduce the film, etc. And it's great to see all the media attention it's getting. It's the reviews are predictably all over the map, as I always knew they would be, because when Wells would make a film, just like Stanley Kubrick, they would always confound people because they never made the same kind of film twice. You know, most directors, like you see a Hitchcock film, you kind of know what to expect. But, and that's even true of Hawks or John Ford to some extent, but with Wells or Kubrick, every new film was a whole new way of striking out into new territory and experimenting, and it if you look at the reviews of their films, often they weren't good at the beginning, and then within 2, 3, 4, 5 years, they would be acclaimed as a masterpiece. That happened with 2001, for example. Kane was considered great from the beginning, but it had problems with Hearst and the distributors. But a lot of Wells films, like Chimes of Midnight, was rejected by critics and audiences at the beginning, and now it's considered a great film. So I expected that would happen with this film, and it's gotten some wonderful reviews and then some dismissive reviews. Most of them are respectful to Wells and their praising of the post-production team. But a lot of the reviews, I think, don't engage with the themes of the film, especially the sexual themes, which are complex. And they talk about sort of side issues or, you know, kind of the style of the film, but not as much about the content. So I wrote a long piece for Sight and Sound, the British film magazine, that came out in the November issue. It came out around early October, actually, and I tried to deal with the history of the film and then analyze, you know, what this film is about and how it carries it out in an unusual way, and I was happy with that, and I think it sort of influenced some of the later reviews. The first reviews in mainstream publications I didn't think were as interesting as some of the ones that are coming out now. In film magazines and blogs and even student newspaper reviews, a lot of very, very interesting comments on the film. So I'm finding it fascinating. You know, I'm learning things about the film that I didn't know after all these years. That's what I like to find from a reviewer, not so much whether I agree with him or not, but do I learn something from it? So I'm learning things from the reviews and from the audience.
What was it like to be on call for this film for so many years, and how did that work?
Well, you know, the first day we did a lot of shooting, and some of the footage is in the film, but Peter Bogdanovich and I were playing two critics, and then later he became famous as a director with The Last Picture Show, which he was about to shoot at that time, and Wells recast him as this hotshot young director who has a really big part in the film, and he's kind of a acolyte, but friendly rival to the Houston character, and he betrays the Houston character, and Wells' films are usually about betrayal, and so Peter is terrific in the film, but they recast his early part with a fellow named Howard Grossman, so we did some reshooting of that. So the opening scenes where we're driving to the party with John Huston were a composite of 1970 and 71 footage, and then Huston was filmed about that, and he roared with laughter. He had never heard that before, but he said he was friendly with Wells, and he immediately did a great John Huston impression. But Huston is perfect in the role. He's so weathered and jaded and cynical and has a lot of stature. You really believe he's a great director because he was in real life. And he's a very enigmatic character who's guarded in his emotions, but in the course of the film, he kind of breaks down and reveals a lot of his inner torment and insecurities and prejudices. And Wells did that very carefully and craftily, because Huston told me, he said acting was a lark. He called it a lark. And Wells wanted to break him down beyond that easy style that Huston had developed. And I think Huston started his career, he wanted to be a serious actor in the 30s. He played Abraham Lincoln on the stage and all that, and then he gravitated to writing, maybe because he thought he wasn't a great actor, or he had problems trying to rival his father, Walter Huston, who was a great actor. And so he had ambitions as an actor once, and Wells was kind of pushing him back in that direction. So finally, in 74, I was called back again after we did a lot of shooting in 71. And then, so we're shooting in Arizona in a house that Wells had rented, and Huston was there, and I was all excited, and I knocked on a door, and Huston was there, and the door opened, and he was pulling out his pants. I was kind of embarrassed, and he came out, and I apologized. I said, "Mr. Huston, I've been acting in this film for 3 years, waiting for you to show up, and I'm really thrilled that you're here." You know, and Huston looked alarmed, and he said, "You've been acting in this film for 3 years?" I think that was the first time he realized what he was getting into. So I did scenes with him, and although I had one big scene with him where he's going to interact with me directly, and he was supposed to pinch my cheek and say, "Always remember, Mr. Pister, that your heart is God's little garden." And then he was supposed to tell me, he said, "Eat a little shit, Mr. Pister. You're going to have to learn to eat a little shit, Mr. Pister," which was his recipe for success in Hollywood. And when it came time to shoot that, Huston was off in Morocco doing The Man Who Would Be King, which I think is his best film. And I asked one of the crew, I said, "Where's John?" He said, "Oh, he's off making some little film, you know." So it seemed like he was gone for 2 months. It was really 4 months, but he goes off and knocks out this masterpiece. And he came back, we were still shooting the same party scenes, you know. And so I never got to do the scene where he pinches my cheek and talks to me. That was Wells doubled that with some guy. But the editing is so good that it looks like he's talking directly to me. It's intercut. There's kind of a longish scene where I try to volunteer helping him to finish the film, which is extremely presumptuous. And so he's kind of caustic toward me in that scene. But it looks like we're together, but we're actually not. But I was in some shots with him. And then I did more shooting. We did a lot of shooting in 1975 at Peter Bogdanovich's home in Bel Air. He was off in Europe directing Daisy Miller, and Wells took over the house and had hordes of people there doing party scenes, and we kept shooting until early 76. We did scenes in a producer's studio as well, various scenes, including some of the drive-in at the end was shot with fog machines, you know, making fog. The drive-in long shots were stock shots, stock footage that they integrated into the film, and at ILM put the film on the screen of this drive-in. It's done very well, but the closer shots of actors were done in the studio, although I'm not in those shots. I was in some scenes, but they didn't make it into the final film. But one funny thing is that in the semi-final scene of the film, I'm passed out at the house where the party is taking place. First you see Edmund O'Brien passed out, and then you see me passed out. I'm sitting there on a couch with a tape recorder playing, and you hear John Huston's voice coming out of the tape recorder, and then the voice goes over the end of the film. And I didn't do those scenes. That was Peter Bogdanovich in his early As they always say in movies, if you're looking at the clothes, you know, or looking at the props, you're looking at the wrong stuff. It's amazing to me that they've, I don't know where they got the shots, you know, my head, and it looks perfect. And they even put 5 o'clock shadow on my face in the closer shot, probably painted that in.
Wow.
That's pretty amazing.
All right, a couple of final questions. What films do you never tire of?
Well, John Ford films I watch a lot, Billy Wilder films, Lubitsch films, Ozu films. Those are my favorite directors. Wells films I've seen so many times. And when you write a book about a director, you see the films 10, 20 times or more. The Magnificent Ambersons is my favorite film of all. That's Orson Welles' second feature and a great film, but it was mutilated by the studio, RKO, and he was fired. He was shooting a film in South America for the government during the post-production of Ambersons. He was ordered by the government to go down there, and they unjustly fired him, claiming he was over budget on this documentary. It's all true, and I found documents proving he was more than $400,000 under budget at the time. They just lied to him. And I did a half-hour video on that situation, how they altered Ambersons and fired him under false pretenses. It's on the Blu-ray of Ambersons that's coming from Criterion. I just love that film. I don't know totally why. I mean, it's a wonderful film in so many ways, but it moves me deeply. I'm from the Midwest, and it's a great film about life in the Midwest, you know, in the era before Wells was born and before I was born. And it's very nostalgic, but also very dark, and it's a deeply dysfunctional family film, which I can relate to because my family was pretty dysfunctional, and I think that's part of it. But I just, the technique is so astounding. James Agee said the film creates a visual suspense in the very act of telling it. You know, the way he shoots scenes is so unexpected. I was struck by that when I first saw the film, that nobody's ever shot scenes like this. Like the opening 10 or so minutes is just amazing.
All right, final question. What is Jimmy Stewart's legacy?
Well, he's got a great legacy, doesn't he? I mean, he made so many classics. That's one way you measure a legacy. Like, I proposed Ingrid Bergman for the AFI Life Achievement Award, and they didn't go for her, which I thought was very short-sighted. And they said, has she made that many good films? I said, well, she's made probably at least 7 of the greatest films ever made. And so with Stewart, you could say that. I mean, there's no doubt. I mean, he's so popular. You know, that's one reason he was chosen. But he's also highly respected as an actor by directors and by critics, who are often, you know, very captious with Hollywood stars. But Stewart has always commanded respect. And you go through his list of films, so many great films of different types. I mean, also, for example, he made so many westerns, which we pointed out on the show. I had Gene Kelly say that, and I said, I forget how many westerns he's made. It's like 17 or 20 or something. And then I had Gene Kelly say, and he's from Princeton.
Yeah.
but he's completely convincing as a western character. The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance is one of the greatest films ever made. And the Anthony Mann westerns, and Destry Rides Again, which is a very good comic western. And then the Frank Capra films are magnificent, the Lubitsch film. But he was good in anything, too. I mean, he's one of those actors who's never really bad. Sometimes he was put in vehicles that were worthy of him. And in later years, I was somewhat disappointed he didn't do more serious films. But he was, you know, I guess it's partly a combination of older actors not getting offered a lot of great roles, and then he was turning parts down. I remember I was told that in the film Hearts of the West, which is a good film about Hollywood, it's a comedy about a young screenwriter coming to Hollywood in the 30s, played by Jeff Bridges, and he becomes friends with an old cowboy actor, and they offered the role to Stewart, who turned it down, and then Andy Griffith played it, and he was terrific. But it's a shame Stewart didn't do that. But he did a film, Fool's Parade, late in his career, which was awfully good. He played a one-eyed bank robber, which is unusual kind of casting. And he had a, you know, this dark, gnarly side to him. And that's a good film, but hardly anybody saw that, you know, and it was probably disappointing for him. And reality, and I was a little, I'm a little disappointed in a way, because I like, you know, Mr. Smith is a more real film, although even there the ending is kind of phony, that the senator bursts in and confesses. Capra had these sort of forced happy endings, so the films are not that different in a way, but Capra really plumbs some of the depths and the highs and lows of Jimmy Stewart, but Stewart had a way of doing that for you. He would take you on a roller coaster ride of emotions in the films. He had a lot of emotion and richness in his personality that more range probably than any other American actor, I would say. Spencer Tracy certainly was one of our great actors, but he was always terrific too. But I think Stewart really surpassed him. And Stewart wound up in better films than Tracy for whatever reason. I suppose you have to give Stewart credit for having good taste in directors too, because when you're a star of that magnitude, you can choose or turn down directors. And some stars, when you read about them, they've made some terrible mistakes. You know, George Raft turned down the Maltese Falcon, and George Jessel turned down the Jazz Singer. And, you know, people make some terrible mistakes, but Stewart, being a smart guy, had a shrewd choice of roles, didn't he? And that really counts for a lot. And he was willing to test himself and push himself beyond what people were comfortable with and what he had done before. He wasn't sitting in his laurels, and his 50s films are just is a great period for him. So he's just right at the top of the list of great movie actors in America, I'd say.
Well, Joseph McBride, thank you very much for taking time to speak with me.
Well, it's really delightful, and I love talking about Stewart. Work I admire so much, and you asked great questions, and thank you so much.
Thank you to Professor Joseph McBride, and a big thanks to Megan Kalsa, one of our Jimmy Stewart Museum volunteers, for arranging this interview. If you listen to us on iTunes, please leave us a review. It will help raise the profile of the podcast and spread the word to other fans. Also, feel free to drop me a note at podcast@jimmy.org. Most of all, I hope you'll plan to visit the Jimmy Stewart Museum in Jimmy's hometown of Indiana, Pennsylvania. For more information, visit jimmy.org. Thank you for listening. Once again, I'm Tim Vanderberg, and we'll be back again soon.